Welcome back to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Henry Price, joined by Chad Bird. Chad, how you doing?
I'm good. Hope everybody else is doing good. Ready to check up on our friend Moses, see what's happening with him.
Yeah, he's about to get the marching orders, as it were. We talked a lot about the divine name, and we talked about some milk and honey, and now God's going to tell him some stuff about the details of how he's going to go about doing this thing.
That's it. That's it. He kind of lays it all out here in these next few verses. So we'll see how Moses reacts to that. See how gung-ho or not very gung-ho he is about this mission.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah. So last time we talked about the, especially the divine name. Moses is at the burning bush, of course, and Moses, first of all, says to God, you know, who am I to go and do this great thing that you're asking me to? And God says, well, look, I'm going to be with you. So I'm going to do this through you. And then Moses follows it up with saying, well, yeah, what name am I supposed to give to the Israelites when I tell them that you've sent me? And so God reveals his name. We talked about that, and tells him, you know, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go, you're going to say, Yahweh, the God of your fathers, appeared to me. He's concerned about you. He knows what's been done to you in Egypt, and he's going to bring you out of here, and he's going to take you all the way to the land that's flowing with milk and honey. So it's kind of where we left it last time, but God isn't quite finished. We still have a few verses left in this speech that God is giving to Moses. So we'll see now kind of the way he lays out the plan. It really, in these next few verses, God more or less summarizes everything that's going to happen. Not, of course, not all the details are there, but the basic gist of what's going to go down in Egypt is laid out here about what Moses is going to say, how Pharaoh's going to react, and then finally how they are going to exit Egypt. So that's what we got there. I'm at verse 18 at this point in chapter 3 of Exodus. So God says, you know, you're going to go to the elders of Israel. So these are the elders of Israel are like many elders in ancient cultures. They're the you know, the judicial leaders, the social leaders of the community. So Moses, it's not like Moses is going to walk in there and do everything on his own. He's going to, as much as he can, enlist the elders to stand beside him, to help him, to help persuade the people. So he's going to go to them first, and then he through them is going to go to the rest of the Israelites. So he and the elders of Israel are they're going to get together, and they're going to go to Pharaoh, and they're going to make this, I don't know if you want to call it a request or a demand, but this is what they are to say: Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So now, please, let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Now, of course, the question arises here is this 3 day journey into the wilderness supposed to be just a 3 day journey into the wilderness and then a return? Or is it kind of an open-ended request? Because technically he doesn't say anything about coming back after they've gone on this 3 day journey into the wilderness. Or is this kind of a test to make this request to Pharaoh and then to see how he's going to react? I mean, is this, it's not honestly that burdensome of a request. We do have some ancient Egyptian records of requests such as this being honored by the leadership of Egypt. You know, they have servants, they have slaves, they have various kinds of groups of people in their midst who are allowed to basically what we would call practice religious freedom. And the 3 days journey actually makes sense because as we hear later on, I think it's in chapter 8, the sacrifices that the Hebrews would have offered would have been an abomination to the Egyptians. So this is kind of, instead of saying, hey, can we celebrate a festival right here in the middle of Egypt in which we make these sacrifices, which would be an abomination to the Egyptians, he's saying, hey, why don't we go out into the wilderness, put some space between us and you, and we'll do our religious thing there, so as not to offend the Egyptians. Now, I guess we could debate as to how completely open and honest this request is, but I think that would really miss the point here, because the way it works out is that Pharaoh doesn't honor the request anyway. In fact, the very next word after God says to Moses, "Hey, this is the request I want you to make to Pharaoh," the very next words out of God's mouth are this: But I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion." So even though this request is going to be made, it's null and void. It's not going to be allowed by the Pharaoh. So if anything, it's an opportunity for this hardness of heart within Pharaoh to manifest itself early on. He will not even allow them to do this. And so the only way that they're going to be able to get out of Egypt is when God uses a strong hand, as the Hebrew literally says there, when he makes them act under compulsion. That's the only way that the Exodus is going to take place.
There's a couple different ways that God causes things to happen. One is when he just sort of speaks things into happening, right? So that this is a creation of the world, blind men getting their sight back, stuff like that, right? And it just happens. This is how salvation works. He just does it. Just regenerates a person. The second birth is completely supernatural. I think that that's a little bit different than God saying, like, "Hey, this isn't going to happen unless under compulsion." Now, the first thing where God just speaks things into being and just causes things to happen, just raises dead men to life. You want that. That's something that, like, we've all had done to us. We were all dead in trespasses and sins, and he rose us from the dead, right? What you don't want is God to have to roll out compulsion on you, because
that's never good.
That's because that means that, like, he's gonna cause you to change your mind, not make you change your mind, but bring about some stuff that's gonna change your mind. That's a much harder thing to deal with.
Yeah, when God makes you cry uncle, it's never good. it's gonna be ugly by the time it's over.
Yes, you know, he could just say, like, "Look, Pharaoh's not gonna do it, so I'm just gonna make him do it because I'm gonna change his heart." And that'd be real nice. I mean, that sounds real good, but that's not exactly what's gonna happen here. He's like, he'll only do it under compulsion, and I'm gonna compulse him.
It's funny that seems to be the way God usually works in my life. It's under compulsion, you know?
Yeah, it's like whenever I read Psalm 23, you know, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures." And I always think, like, yeah, sometimes he does make you lie down. Like,
yeah, I have this picture of God, like, you know, he's got his knees on me, pressing me into the ground.
Oh, you're going to lie down. You can lie down, or you can be made to lie down. You know, either one.
Yeah, either way, it's going to happen. Yeah, this can be easy, or this can be hard. And for some reason, I always choose the hard way. You're 6 years old. You know, you think I would have learned by now, but it doesn't seem to work that way.
Yeah, you always you're constantly pulling a Pharaoh.
Yeah, yeah, I've got a little Pharaoh that is quite at home inside my heart. And so God is constantly plaguing him to twist his arm into going his way. I mean, that is a great image. A lot of the church teachers throughout the centuries have spoken of the old Adam that we drag around with us, our sinful nature, as a Pharaoh. You know, he's only going to do things under compulsion. So, you know, that's the thing about our sinful nature. The only way it's going to cooperate is by force. So, you know, you still have to have the law, which threatens and cajoles and twists the arm of the old Adam and forces him to do what God desires. So that, you know, the new man within us, created by faith in baptism, this new nature that we have, doesn't need any of that. It's just like, you know, it's like the fruit tree that just bears fruit. You know, it doesn't have to really think about it or be forced into it. It just does. So it needs no law because it automatically does what God demands. But Pharaoh, on the other hand, the old Adam than us is a completely different animal. He has to be constantly forced by the strong hand of God to do things under compulsion. So we got this dual reality going on with us all the time. Part of us is always willing and ready to do good works, and part of us is always willing and ready to be obstinate and to do only what it desires.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting point, that whenever I see that that word there, compulsion, I'm like, that's not good.
No, compulsion is never a good word when God is the subject and we are the object. It's never going to be pretty in the end.
Yeah, like it's like when you have an all-powerful being saying, "I'm going to make you a deal you can't refuse." That's not good.
No, we know who's going to win. Yeah, and as the rest of the history, as it appears here in these next few chapters, makes abundantly clear, you know, by the 10th plague, Pharaoh has been compulsed quite enough. He's lost just about everything. And then he finally, after all of this, finally lets them go. You know, but the amazing thing about that is, even though he has been forced under compulsion to do this, you notice what he does, and I know we're getting way ahead of the story here, but you notice what he does immediately after he finally says, okay, just go. He changes his mind. Well, and he pursues them into the wilderness.
Yeah, I think there's a great law gospel thing to be said about that. And I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about it the time we get there, but it's kind of what like compulsion with punishment and law does, because it doesn't have any ability to change your heart. And the goal here that God is not, for whatever reason, he knows why, he's not attempting to change Pharaoh's heart. He's compulsing him to do this thing. And, you know, the gospel comes in, grace comes in and changes your heart and gives you different desires. But compulsion is a being forced into it. But this is what the law does. Like it demands eventually, and you finally say, like, fine, okay. Mm-hmm. But you also do it begrudgingly. You do it angrily. I mean, when he does this, I mean, he's angry. He's ticked off. You see that play out there, like, and he's like that, and you see that wrath then that he, in which he goes after the Israelites. That's what happens when the law is used. I mean, it's God using it here to draw out these distinctions for us to see. But it does tell us something as people, as we try to get people to change or do things the way we want them to do. Compulsion won't change. That didn't change their heart, man. It might make them do it, but it won't end up yielding good fruit.
Yeah, that's the thing about the law. You can always get some kind of result from it. You know, you can guilt people into it. You can twist people's arms into it. You can do whatever you want with the law, and you will get some at least temporary results, but it's going to be for all the wrong reasons. And eventually it's going to lead to the opposite of what you desire, because people are acting not by the Spirit of God, but under compulsion. So in the end, the law ends up, the actions of using the law to accomplish this good actually undermines the very purpose that that a person set out with.
Yeah. All right. Well, now that we've got way ahead, how's this going to
work? Yeah, I guess we can just jump to Exodus 16 now, since we've covered all these intervening chapters. Yeah, so God says, listen, I tell him this, and I know that the king of Egypt won't permit you to go except under compulsion. So here's what I'm going to do. And this, you know, this is, like I said earlier, he's kind of summarizing what's going to unfold in his next few chapters. He said, I'm going to stretch out my hand and I will strike Egypt. Oh, that's never good. I will strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it. And after that, he will let you go. There's sort of a play on words here in the Hebrew that I like too. This idea of stretching out. Actually, the same verb occurs two times in this verse. It's kind of like I will send out my hand against him, and he will send you out from Egypt. So you got a cause and effect going on here. God is going to stretch out or send out his hand, and he's going to smite. He's going to strike Egypt, and after that, then Pharaoh will stretch you out or send you out of Egypt as a result of it. But he says, not only is that going to happen, but I will also, God says, I will also grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. So every woman's going to ask of her neighbor and the woman who lives in her house for articles of silver and articles of gold and for clothing, and says, you shall put them on your sons and daughters, and thus you will plunder the Egyptians. So you have this remarkable reversal that's going to take place. The slaves are going to be enriched by their masters, and thus leave their masters impoverished. And there's some justice in this, because these people had been enslaved. And so this is, in some small way, a remuneration for all of the servitude they'd suffered and the deprivation that they have undergone. They are now enriched by the Egyptians as they leave. So, and which, you know, and that's what happened. And actually, come to think of it, this isn't the first time that we've heard this, because way back in Genesis chapter 12, this was already prophesied when God spoke to Abraham about, you know, what was going to happen in future generations. He talked about how he was going to, I don't know if it's Exodus 12 or not, but how he was going to send his people. Here it is. He says that his descendants are going to be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. This is Genesis 15. But he's going to judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward, they will come out with many possessions. So this isn't the first time that God has promised this. Already in Genesis 15, this was promised. So it's finally now coming to fulfillment. So we kind of have a whole picture here. Moses is going to approach Pharaoh, make the request. Pharaoh is going to stubbornly refuse. God's going to strike Egypt. He doesn't say how at this point, but he says he's going to strike Egypt till finally he lets you go. And when you do go, you're not going out empty-handed. You're going to go out with all this plunder from the Egyptians. Makes it sound so easy. I mean, that's all we got to do, right? It's all summarized in these few verses. But things don't go quite that easily. There's going to be a few bumps along the road. That takes us to the end of chapter 3.
Look at that.
Yeah, making some progress here. So God's been talking a lot. He started talking way before the end of chapter 3. And presumably Moses has been just standing there listening, taking all this in. And no doubt Moses is beginning in his mind to grasp the enormity of what God is asking him to do. He's just now heard, of course, what Pharaoh's reaction is going to be. And no doubt Moses is thinking, okay, what is it? What does God mean by striking the Egyptians? And what all is that going to entail?
These two words, like this phrase is a confusing phrase. Like when you hear the word miracles, you think nice thoughts.
Yeah. Everybody's happy at the end of a miracle, right?
You think about, like, when someone says, dude, it was a miracle, they're not like, it was a miracle, my aunt got cancer. Wait, what? Like, you know, it was a miracle, something felt like an asteroid fell out of the sky on my house. No, you're like, that's not a miracle. That's like a tragedy.
Yeah.
It's not a miracle.
Yeah, it's like a curse or something. Yeah.
And so when that's sort of implied with the word strike. So like this phrase, like I'm gonna strike them with my miracles, is like, wait, what?
Striking with miracles that does not fit together in our mindset.
No, not at all. No, like I think because of the, you know, I mean, again, I mean, like Old or New Testament, most of the time miracles are good. I mean, like we see miracles in the Old Testament, we see miracles in the New Testament. By and large, they're very good things. Miraculous acts of grace and compassion, but when you hear the word strike, like that's never good. You ever hear about someone being struck with healing?
No. But I'm glad that you brought it up because that is a great point, and I think it accents something that is often overlooked, that the miracles of God serve a dual purpose. They're one, of course, is what we ordinarily think of. They are there to manifest the grace of God in restoring sight, or, you know, restoring physical health, or even life, you know, like in the case of Lazarus or the widow's son at Nain.
Yeah, or feeding 5,000.
Yeah, or feeding 5,000. I mean, all of these have this positive side to them. This is God bringing about a restoration of creation. This is him acting really as, when Jesus does his miracles of healing and of feeding and all of that, these are Jesus acting as creator. He's showing to the world that he is the one who spoke everything into being at the beginning, and thus he is the one who speaks into recreation or into restoration as the creator made flesh. So that's one, certainly one good and positive purpose of the miracles. But you notice that they have this dark side too, because when you have miracles happen, it also provides an opportunity for those who reject Christ, who reject this gracious action of God, to complain and to murmur and to reject Christ. You know, so when the man is healed of his sight in the Gospel of John, it gives an occasion on the part of the Pharisees to attack him and to attack Christ. And even when the multitudes are fed in the wilderness, what do they turn right around and do? They try to make Jesus into a bread king. So the miracles kind of serve a dual purpose. And I guess you could say this about, you could say this about any gracious action of God. It is there to engender faith and thanksgiving in the hearts of people, but it's also there as a sign against unbelief, and it gives unbelievers, those who reject the love of God, it gives them an opportunity to basically to rebel even against this gracious action. So that's that other side of miracles that I don't think that we hear. That we hear enough about, but which actually fits with how God works and with how people react. Anytime that you have a gracious action of God, that could be in a miracle, that can be in God forgiving someone, there is this flip side to it where there's always going to be a negative reaction to that on the part of sinners, in which they reject this instead of seeing it as something they should receive with thanksgiving. So yeah, in the case of Egypt, to kind of return to the story here, that's what is going to happen. I mean, these miracles that God is going to work, most of these have a very negative flavor to them, of course. Uh, But it's an opportunity for the Israelites to believe and for Pharaoh and those who follow him to reject. So they are the decisive action of God that splits people between believing with thanksgiving the miracle or disbelieving with stubbornness and with rejection.
Yeah, and this language has got to be something that gives Moses pause here, that makes him wonder, okay, what's happening? So we're going to do compulsion and we're going to strike people with miracles. Okay, like this like sounds like this is not going to be a super pleasant thing that goes down, right? And I mean, and I think that like to try to wrap your head around, like you were saying, sort of the enormity of what it is that God is saying he's going to have him do. This isn't like, you know, calling you to lead 25 people, you know, into the promised land. Or so. You're talking about millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is the
nation of Israel.
I mean, Moses got to be thinking wait a minute, man. How are we going to like feed all these people? How are we going to shelter all these? What are you talking about? I don't want to be responsible for a couple million people.
Right.
Out tending sheep, bro.
I'm 80 years old. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I think this is finally, I mean, he's already been hesitant, of course, you know, who am I to do this and what's your name and all of this. And so it rather than actually encouraging him, everything that God has said has just filled him with greater fear about what's going to be required of him. And so because of all that, because of what God has said, rather than being reassured, Moses is now going to continue his protest against God sending him to do this. And this is where we get to beginning of chapter 4. So after God has spoken, then Moses answers and says, well, what if they won't believe me or listen to what I say? I mean, they may say, the Lord has not appeared to you. So this is another objection. You know, who am I and what's your name? And now it's, well, what if they don't believe me? I mean, yeah, I'm here now. I'm listening to you. You are in the burning bush. We're having this conversation face to face. So it's one thing for me to believe because I'm hearing it with my own ears, but what if they're not going to believe in what I say? The Lord didn't appear to you, they might say. So what about that? Well, again, I want to accent what I said either in the last episode or maybe even the one before then. God is patient. This whole story has amazed me about the patience of God. I mean, there's a give and take here. Moses will say something. God will say something. Moses will say something. God will say something. God is being extremely patient with him. He's taking into account Moses' hesitation and his fear and his misgivings. And instead of just simply saying, listen, Moses, shut up and go do what I'm saying, he actually answers him. He gives him reasons. He tells him how this is going to work. So this whole narrative is a demonstration of the patience of God with the hesitancy of people. Now, I know he's not always like that in every single narrative in the scriptures, but here he is. He's taking his time. He's like a very fatherly figure here with Moses. So here's how God responds at this point. So Moses says, how are they going to believe me? And God says, well, all right, I'm going to show you how they're going to believe you. He says, what's in your hand? And Moses kind of, you know, he looks at his hand. He says, well, a staff, you know, this is a shepherd's crook that he would use for the sheep. And God says, well, throw it on the ground. So he throws it on the ground and it turns into a snake. And Moses runs away from it. Which is great. You know, God doesn't tell Moses ahead of time, hey, here's what we're going to do. You know, throw your staff on the ground. It's going to turn into a snake. He surprises Moses. Moses runs away from it, as we all would. And Moses' reaction is a great object lesson for himself, because his fear is going to be the same fear that the eyewitnesses of this event are going to have later on. And then God says to Moses, "Well, stretch out your hand and grab it by its tail." So he stretched out his hand and caught it, and then it reverts into a staff once more. Now, I think that the greater miracle here is not that the staff turned into a snake, but that Moses actually grabbed the snake by the tail. That's a pretty amazing feat, if you ask me. But he does it. So we have a staff turning into a snake, and then back into a staff. And then God follows this up by saying, so this is going to happen in order that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has appeared to you. So here is the first miracle, if you will, or as some commentators call it, a magic trick. It's not really a magic trick. It's a divine sign. And God immediately goes into a second one. He doesn't even give Moses a chance to object or to come up with another excuse yet. He says, immediately says then, "Now, I want you to put your hand into your bosom." So Moses puts his hand into his bosom, and he pulls it out, and his hand is leprous, like snow. And he tells him to put his hand into his bosom again, and he does, and when he takes it out, it's restored like the rest of his flesh. So, of course, the two signs are parallel. You have a change that takes place from something good, from something to bad, and then it reverts back. So God is the God who can cause this malady to happen, and then who can restore it. He has this creative power to enable this to take place. And both of these then are signs that Moses is going to be able to use to convince the Israelites. And he says, in verse 8, he says, and here's what's going to happen. If they won't believe you because of the first sign, then they'll believe you because of the second sign. So if they don't believe the whole, you know, serpent staff, then they'll believe the leper's hand. But then God isn't done yet. He still is not going to let Moses interrupt, because he says, look, I tell you what, if they won't believe these two signs, if they still won't listen to what you say, because it's almost as if God is saying, listen, I know these people, I know the Israelites, I know how slow of heart they are to believe. And so if by chance these first two signs don't work, then I tell you what you need to do. Then you take some water from the Nile and you pour it on dry ground, and that water that you pour will become blood. So those are two signs that Moses actually acts out there on Mount Sinai. And then the third sign, of course, he can't yet because he's not in Egypt, but that will be one that he can use once he gets down into Egypt. So this is the way that God responds to Moses' hesitation about whether the people are actually going to believe him. So that's the first objection that we come to in this chapter. But Moses isn't done yet. And what he comes to next is a complaint about his inability to speak with eloquence. So this is where God is finally, in the context of this conversation, God is finally going to lose his patience with Moses. Because Moses then, after these signs, he follows it up by saying, well, look, God, I have never been eloquent. Not recently, not a long time ago, not since you've been speaking to me. So he says, it's not like I have all of a sudden become eloquent while you're talking to me. He says, I'm not an ish davarim in Hebrew. I'm not a man of words. I'm not eloquent. He says, I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue. Now, commentators debate as to what exactly Moses is talking about. You know, whether he might have actually had some kind of speech impediment. We don't know. That certainly is a possibility. He could just be making an exaggerated claim about his inability to speak with eloquence. You know, he's not the man of rhetoric. So he's he's now really reflecting back upon his own physical limitations. So he was first of all worried about the people not believing him, and now he's worried about not being able to speak to them. And God's response is this. He says, "Moses, who made man's mouth? Who makes him deaf or dumb or seeing or blind? Isn't it I, the Lord? Now go, and I, even I," he says, "will be with your mouth, and I will teach you what you are to say." So this excuse isn't going to work either. Moses is going to be the mouthpiece of God. Just like he said earlier, "I will be with you," and now he says, "I will be with your mouth." So when it comes time to speak, I'm going to give you the words to say. And it's not a matter of eloquence. It's a matter of power. It's not a matter of you using flowery speech. It's a matter of you actually speaking my powerful words in order to bring about what I desire. And then finally, and this kind of wraps up the excuses that Moses gives. Finally, at this point, Moses can't think of anything else to say. And so he says, "Please, God, send the message by whomever you want." In other words, anybody but me. So he's gone through his whole list of excuses. You know, who am I that you should send me? Well, what's your name? Well, what if they won't believe me? I can't speak. So he's exhausted every excuse he can think of. And so finally, he just basically tries to beg off and says, "Well, just choose somebody else. Send whomever you want. Just don't make it me." And it's at this point, and only at this point, that God gets angry. He says, "Then the anger of the Lord burned against Moses." And he was one lucky guy, because usually anytime you hear about the anger of God burning against someone, whatever's going to happen next is not going to be pretty. It's going to be catastrophic. But instead of, you know, destroying Moses or something like that, instead, God simply says, "Well, okay, then we'll go to plan B." He says, "Look, you've got a brother, Aaron, who's a Levite." This is the first we've heard of Aaron. He's an older brother of Moses. He's 3 years older, 3 years older than Moses. And God says, "Look, I know that Aaron can speak fluently. And what's more, he is actually on his way out to meet you right now." So this is the first we've heard about this. I guess this is sort of a backstory that we're just not told about. God had must have appeared to Aaron in Egypt and told him to come meet Moses out in the wilderness. So Aaron is actually on his way. And God says, "Look, here's what you are to speak to Aaron and put your words in his mouth. And I'll be with your mouth and I'll be with his mouth and I'll teach you what you are to do. And he will speak for you to the people. And it'll come about that Aaron will be as a mouth for you, and you shall be as God to him. So take your staff in your hand, and you can use that to perform the signs, and Aaron will be your mouthpiece." So Moses is not getting out of this. I mean, he's tried everything that he can, and yet nothing is able to break him free of the Lord's assignment. And you know, this is like so many of the call narratives. God has to push people into fulfilling his mission because they feel themselves unworthy in some way. But it implicit in all of this is that God did not choose Moses because he was eloquent. God didn't choose Moses because he was so persuasive. God didn't choose Moses because he had, you know, this list of credentials a mile long that really, you know, put him at the top as the one who was to deliver Israel. God chose Moses because he was the seemingly wrong man for the job. God was going to use Moses' weaknesses to display his strength. He was going to use Moses' lack of eloquence in order to demonstrate the power of his word. So this is God basically using his own foolishness to show how foolish the wisdom of the world truly is. He's working through that which is his seeming opposite in order to bring about this release from captivity for his people Israel.
Yeah, man, and that's it.
That's it. That's 40 minutes.
40 minutes. All right, we covered quite a bit. The conversation between God and Moses is over for now, and we're gonna see Moses meet up with Aaron and stuff, I believe, next time.
Yeah, and stay tuned for one of the most unusual narratives in all of Exodus, when God meets Moses, and we have the story of him and his wife and his uncircumcised son. So some strange stuff coming up here. So stay tuned.
Yeah, yeah. Well, guys, hey, I don't know if you've done this yet, but you really ought to by the time this comes out. There's a conference coming up next year. Seems like a long ways away, because it is. It's next October. It's going to be crazy. It's going to be a big, huge party. It's in San Diego, California. Ton of speakers are going to be there. Me and Chad are both going to be there. But there's going to be a lot of stuff going on. Food and music and speaking. And if you get in by the end of the year, December 31st, that's the cutoff date, you can get in to this thing for dirt cheap. So the cutoff date for the super early bird ticket price is December 31st. So you should go over to hereWeStillStand.org and see if you can grab yourself some tickets to that event. Figure out the travel later, but we would love to see you guys there. We're going to celebrate the 500th anniversary of Reformation. It's going to be a blast. All right. We will see you guys next week. Thanks for joining us.